I'm probably contradicting something that I said earlier, but I think he was taking a real story and doing just his best to try and hone to it, while at the same time understanding that even telling a real story is fiction.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. The narrative voice in Death in the Woods by Sherwood Anderson is an important feature of this classic story. From it, we receive the strange, sad story of a woman he describes as rather typical and common, the type of person who is, quote, nothing special, and whom we all know in our own lives. And yet, the story itself is told in such a close way, brimming with details that go beyond some kind of mere distant familiarity we have with someone random. The woman had lived in extremely difficult and bleak circumstances for her entire life. We learn this from what the narrator shares, and yet we wonder how he could possibly know the intimate details of her life, or even of the way she dies. And this becomes one of the most important things to talk about and admire in this story. The story has been so often anthologized. Perhaps we receive the story in brand new ways with each new reading, and this is how it is with a story such as this one. That is, that it's one, as the narrator reminds us, that must be told slowly and with care over time. We receive a story in brand new ways with each rereading. Maybe we need to read this one again when we're older, when we can examine the motives of the two young brothers in the story and the ways they retell the story at the exact same time that we're receiving it from the narrator, one of the brothers, when he's older and some time and distance has passed. As we read the final of the story's five sections, we come to realize that the story is about storytelling. It parses the idea of narrative, breaks it apart, puts it back together again. It's fragmented, but it is a composite whole. It's reconstructed and rooted in imagining what could have happened. So some of this comes from the narrator's imagining, and yet, as he tells us, he's trying to tell us a real story, one about the woman, one about himself as a storyteller, one for us all. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Death in the Woods by Sherwood Anderson.
I hate to make any sort of foundational argument about any particular story or any particular writer, but I think if I ever was to make one, Death in the Woods, I would make the kind of comment that people make about, and people have made, I think it was Turgenev, I think Hemingway also repeated it, was that we all come out from under Gogol's overcoat. Who said that? Somebody said it. I think it was Turgenev, but I think it's sometimes credited to Dostoevsky, or who knows? Maybe nobody ever said it, but it makes a lot of sense that the overcoat would have been a story that you could say that about, that you could say that other things came out of it. I think this is definitely one of those, if there is such a thing. All the stories that have come as a result of this one would be many if you calculated them.
I read something that Charles Baxter said about the short story form just lends itself so well to somebody like Anderson.
Yeah, as it does to human beings. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I revere Charles Baxter very much. He was my teacher. He's my friend, and he's right. But I think the reason he's saying that is because the story form lends itself to human beings that have this need, as the boys do at the end of this story, have this need and this great joy, this great sort of hunger to tell. But they're kids, they don't have anything to tell. But today, tonight, they do have something to tell. And is there a more human impulse than this need that we have to spread the news?
It is very much this Frank O'Connor idea, right? So Baxter says it's about lives in which a fundamental need is frustrated. So yeah, that's what the short story does best.
But I'm just saying, like, it doesn't have to be a frustration either. I think it's a joy too. I think it's a It's this thing we do. So these boys, as sad as they are at the time about this woman, what they are is excited to tell their story. It's only later, I think, that the real sorrow enters the memory of the teller. So I don't know exactly where frustration would come in necessarily, in the sense that no one is, except for one thing, and it's huge. And so I take everything back I just said. The frustration comes because his brother is the one that tells the story that night. He doesn't. And he is frustrated about something in the way that the brother tells the story that does not capture the story to his liking. And that is why, and it takes the boy decades. This is Anderson worked on the story for, I think, over a decade. The final version, which we read for today, is late in his life. I forget how old he was when he died. But so I think the frustration to get this story right is entirely right. And may Charles Baxter forgive me. We'll have to send this to him.
He was 64 when he died in that very terrible way.
How did he die?
He swallowed a toothpick.
No, really?
Yes, and he died of peritonitis. So it got infected. Isn't that terrible?
Oh, it's right out of Anderson.
It is.
I'm sure I'm not the only person who's ever said that.
So they had to do an autopsy. He was on a cruise to South America. He had some kind of stomach ache. They did an autopsy and they found that he had swallowed a toothpick. It had done some kind of internal damage and he had peritonitis.
Wow.
And that's how he died.
But it is something that literally could have been in Winesburg, Ohio. You know, the neighbor who died of a toothpick overdose or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So Death in the Woods. Okay, I want to talk about this woman. I want to talk about the death or the woman who ends up dying. She was somebody who did not have a great life to begin with.
I think it's important to think about when we talk about this story, that this story is an invention, almost a meta invention. Like we are seeing in real time, a fiction writer create a character on the page. And so while this woman is so real to me, at the same time, Anderson cues me a number of times, especially in this final version, that much of the life that he creates for her as a fiction writer is based on things he experienced and put together as possibilities of the backstory of this woman's life. There really was this woman, and I believe in my heart that she really did die this way in the woods, surrounded by 7 dogs who did this incredible thing when she was dying and after she died, as they ran in circles around her. That basic outline of the story, a poor old woman trying to get back to her farm after having been in town to get some eggs, or she sold eggs, I believe, and she brought home meat in exchange for those eggs and some liver and some bones with a bit of meat on them, and ends up succumbing to the elements or a heart attack. Who knows exactly what happened to her, but she ends up dying in the woods. The dogs do this crazy thing, and then she's found. And one of the finders was Sherwood Anderson as a young boy. He takes that story of finding this woman, and he wasn't the finder. The finder was a hunter, but he came out with the rest of the townspeople to look at the body. From that, seeing the body on the ground, Anderson then tells us, he creates a story around this woman that parts of it are from memory and parts of it are from invention.
And two things really happened. There was the discovery of a woman in the woods that really happened. And the backstory of the woman is, I believe, taken partly from his mother's life. So to complicate things further, I've been looking at a storyteller's story, which is this, it's an autobiography, but right up front, we are told that his 3 autobiographies do nothing but confuse readers. They're all told sort of from a different perspective and a different tone, and different things happen, or slightly different things happen. But there is this thing that happens that's described early on about his mother, where he says, "Mother was tall and slender and had once been beautiful. She had been a bound girl in a farmer's family when she married father, and he was an improvident young dandy." That's very different from the father in Death in the Woods, of course. But there's this interesting idea about the mother's backstory and how Sherwood Anderson's father was always taking off somewhere. He was always disappearing. He was always flying off somewhere. And the mother was left alone to take care of the children. And sometimes they had to subsist on cabbage. And he has this bit in there about how, you know, how Russian that is. You know, he identifies with Russian writers because of this diet of cabbage that he had to endure as a child. It's all very sad and dark and terrible. And it aligns with a little bit of the story of the woman in Death in the Woods, who was also a bound girl who ends up having to marry this man who treated her so badly. And she had to find a way to feed everybody. Like, she lived to try to feed everybody, the human beings, the dogs, the pigs, and all the other animals on the farm. Like, that was her life, was trying to feed everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. And I and all that fascinating story of Anderson writing this story, like I said, is really just so compelling to me, because it circles back around to fiction. I think that ultimately Anderson, he felt very deeply about this woman and her circumstance, no question about it. And yet it wasn't until the final version, when he realized, and forgive me, he realized that it was entertainment. This story was not a lecture, and it wasn't a socioeconomic examination, but a wild adventure for two boys on a winter night somewhere in the Midwest. And it was that point that he does this remarkable thing. Because in one of the biographies, when he tries to tell this story, he tells it in the third person. It's ridiculous. He becomes the character's Tar, but it's him. And I think why the story works so well in its final form is that he circles back around to a first-person narrative telling a fictional story, not a real story, a fictional story. And that, I think, is what ultimately makes this, like I said, this sort of foundational piece of work that is not a foundational piece of work of sociology. My thought is that it's arguably a foundational short story for anyone who's come after it, but because it's fiction, not because it's nonfiction, not because it's sociology, not because it's making a statement.
I always think about how it starts. Those first couple of paragraphs where he's talking about the woman going to the butcher's, asking for some dog meat, etc. And then he says, people drive right down a road and never notice an old woman like that. And then the very next paragraph starts with, there was such an old woman who used to come into town past our house one summer and fall when I was a young boy. And goes on, the old woman was not. That's a very sort of Anderson kind of a thing. It's something that I noticed in the story Seeds when I was rereading that recently. There's a kind of a story, but and then it turns into another story, and it's all good. You know, we just sort of accept that it's all connected, that it's all intrinsic, and it's going to make sense by the time you get to the end, which it does in its way. I do see how, as you said, he cues the reader. In this very next bit, he says, the old woman was nothing special. She was one of the nameless ones that hardly anyone knows, but she got into my thoughts. I have just suddenly now, after all these years, remembered her and what happened. It is a story.
Right. And we know that is a bold-faced, if we were to take this story as if it was nonfiction, a bold-faced lie.
Yeah.
The story has been in his mind for at least a decade, and probably at this point, and I think he wrote it in his 60s, for probably 5 decades. You know, and it's such a, I just think it's a head fake, you know, and what is so beautiful and brilliant about it is that it's so convincing.
When he says, I wonder how I know all this. It must have stuck in my mind from small town tales when I was a boy. And that's in the middle of a long paragraph. It's just stuck in there, and it sticks out. So things like that. It is a story. I wonder how I know all this.
Almost, I mean, you could argue some of that's cheesy. And there's even a line late in the story that felt cheesy to me. Ultimately, I think that it's the image of the story that is so powerful, and you can understand why the story carried so many years in his mind. I mean, you know, you're talking about a very talented, well-loved, well-respected writer of his time who wrote a lot of stories, and a lot of them are incredibly memorable. But this was the one that I think was memorable to him. And I think that's why it persisted in his mind, that he wanted desperately to tell this story about an old woman who was found in the woods with basically an oval path trod by dogs in the snow around her, because the dogs have been doing laps around her body. And he actually says in this final version that had once happened to him as a boy or as a young man, that he had basically fallen asleep in the woods and the dogs he was with started to circle him. And he makes a comment where he says, "But I was not intending to die at all." But the behavior that the dogs manifest when he is himself in that situation is the same as what happened with the old woman. So he's convincing us that this is possible. It's possible what happened to her when the dogs started doing that circling. And it's such an incredibly haunting image that it carries the entire story and allows, I think, then for all the layers of her life and the specifics about her husband and the brother, which are, frankly, you know, I think so extreme, not to be unbelievable, of course. God knows people behave to each other a lot more cruel than they do to the father and son do to this old woman in this story. But there is this part of me that feels that it's almost so ginned up against her. And yet even that somehow doesn't matter, because there's a certain dignity or a certain kind of mystery in the way her death happens and the scene that's created in the mind of this boy who sees it, that kind of redeems what I might argue are kind of a weakness in the story. Oh, it's so bad. The husband, of course the husband's bad. Of course the son's bad. Of course she's poor. Of course she has to feed everybody. You know what I mean? And then there's something mystical happens to her, and that's what's captured.
I wondered about that, this reading, at just how extreme they're brutes, the father and the son especially somehow. And it is just so extreme. It's irremediable. I mean, it's like she has nothing. It's like she's this terrible prisoner. It's so extreme.
That strikes me as being, of course, that's what, you know, the constraint of truth.
It has to be that way, because I feel like anything kind of lukewarm about her background is just, and her son loved her and he was a good boy. And then there's almost no point. Then the story isn't satisfying. You know, when his brother tells the story, he's like, that's not a good version of the story, right? It has to have these other elements so that when we see her as readers in the snow, looking like a young girl, looking like something out of, I don't know, with the snow and the ice and everything else, like diamonds or something, you know, cast in this other kind of light. That's the only way it can work. Such things happened in towns of the Middle West. He says, they dragged the old woman's body out into the open clearing, that whole section. And it says, her body was frozen stiff when it was found, and the shoulders were so narrow and the body so slight that in death it looked like the body of some charming young girl. Such things happened in towns of the Middle West, on farms near town when I was a boy. So it is like this extreme thing, and then this other extreme thing of this body in the woods. And he interjects again that first, this is a story, but then stuff like this can really happen. This very interesting interjections that are sort of opposed, but they, of course, they work for me.
I mean, can I disagree? is that I don't think there's inevitability in the fact that the husband and the son are bad. And I don't necessarily think that the story would change if they had more actual nuance. I just think that almost nothing can go wrong given the death scene. I think Anderson knew this husband and that son and knew they were assholes. And then he just decided, you know what, I'm not going to deploy my powers of fiction writer to make them any more than they were. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But I think in some stories, it would matter if you seem to gin up the villains. But in this story, it just doesn't matter. They're almost, I mean, yeah, like you say, of course they're bad. I don't necessarily think it's inevitable that they would have to be bad for the story to work. I just think that that's sort of just how it fell. And there's a certain sense of just like this kind of that you feel this kind of raw honesty that he was just working with what he had. And so I'm probably contradicting something that I said earlier, but I think he was taking a real story and doing just his best to try and hone to it, while at the same time understanding that even telling a real story is fiction. Like, you know what I mean? And I think it's actually good when we disagree.
No, even telling a real story is fiction.
It sounds good. I don't know if it's bullshit or not, but I just kind of, there's something like, I would make the argument, this is a story of Anderson's life, the truly great one. And it came at a time when critics and, you know, especially Hemingway, who wrote a whole novel making fun of Anderson, not a very good novel. I'm just going to make a gratuitous comment about Hemingway being a real anti-Semite. I mean, not just an anti-Semite for kicks, but a real anti-Semite. But anyway, at this point in Anderson's career, he was not well respected by other writers and on the downhill. And if you look at the rest of the stories in Death in the Woods, as interesting as they are and as good as some of them are, they're nothing compared to this one. And it's almost heartbreaking to read a story this good at the beginning of a collection and then have it all sort of fall apart. It's just so striking. But I I'm not an Anderson scholar. I feel for a writer whose powers are waning, who is able to just reach back and retell something that they've already told in two different books and do it in this way that transcends those two tellings. And it's through those fictional techniques when he's almost being cheesy, almost being like a parody of himself. These are the things that happen to a boy in the Midwest in the winter. I mean, it's so close to the line of not working, but then there's a sentence like this. My brother and I were silent. He had his bundle of papers in a bag slung over his shoulder. When he got back to town, he would have to go on distributing his papers before he went home to supper. If I went along, as he no doubt already determined I should, we would both be late. Either mother or our older sister would have to warm our supper. Well, we would have something to tell. A boy did not get such a chance very often. It was lucky we just happened to go into the grocery where the hunter came in. The hunter was a country fellow. Neither of us had ever seen him before. Now the crowd of men and boys had got to the clearing. Darkness comes quickly on such winter nights, but the moon made darkness comes quickly on such winter nights, but the moon, sorry. This is just such an extraordinary sentence, I can barely say it. Darkness comes quickly on such winter nights, but the full moon made everything clear. My brother and I stood near the tree beneath which the old woman had died. All's forgiven, you know? Yeah. And they're going to get home late, and it's going to be the mother or their older sister is going to have to warm their dinner, but it's all worth it because they're going to have a story. And that's why it was so lucky that they happened to be in the drugstore when the hunter came in to tell the story. And that's why, again, I'm kind of overemphasizing this today, and I don't even know why, except that the story is not, you know, a moral tale. It's really almost about how this stuff excites us, as awful as that sounds.
When you read the story and you realize that that she has died and the dogs have done this thing. And you sort of realize there's still two more sections to go.
Yeah.
It's the other part of it. And then after the section you just read, there is this sense of the story that he's telling is sort of the story about the story. Just as you said, when we first started talking, this meta thing, she had died. And then he says, she did not look old lying there in that light, frozen and still. One of the men turned her over in the snow and I saw everything. My body trembled with some strange mystical feeling and so did my brothers. It might have been the cold. Neither of us had ever seen a woman's body before. It may have been the snow clinging to the frozen flesh that made it look so white and lovely, so like marble. No woman had come with the party from town, but one of the men, he was the town blacksmith, took off his overcoat and spread it over her. Then he gathered her into his arms and started off to town, all the others following silently. At that time, no one knew who she was. And to my mind, that is still him telling the story, adding the details, and I'll just say it, and enjoying describing these things.
Right.
Not in any way except that it is a good story. It is a story worth the telling. Does that sound terrible?
No, and I don't think it's exploitative either. I think it's let's say this woman's real. And I think we both agree that this is, you know, based on something real. You know, I think it's some cosmic sense of honoring somebody who wouldn't be remembered is a net positive, I think. And I think that's, you know, what he's up to here ultimately is that he almost desperately wants to honor this memory and this woman. But I absolutely think that the story, it's because it's a good story. And I just think we just got to own that.
In a storyteller's story, there's a section where he says, to us at home, father was always somewhat strangely apart and at the same time, not a part of our lives. He flew in and out as a bird flies in and out of a bush. And I'm quite sure that all through the years of our childhood, it never occurred to him to ask when he set off on one of his winter adventures, whether or not there was anything for us to eat in the house. The fall came with its snows and the little creeping fear of actual starvation for her brood that must often have been in mother's mind. So, you know, when I think about that part of the mother's, you know, the bound girl, the mother that was married to this man and had to find a way to feed children. And then I think about this story, the idea of what's real and what's not, what makes a good story, and what are the details that he can pull from his real life, but as you say, even telling a real story is fiction. To me, all of that comes to this point in the story where he then says near the very end, the whole thing, the story of the old woman's death, which I think of as the old woman's life too, was to me as I grew older, like music heard from far off. The notes had to be picked up slowly, one at a time. Something had to be understood. And before that, he says, the fragments you see had to be picked up slowly, long afterwards, the fragments of the story. It's the narrator or Anderson or whomever, the boy as a man, saying to us, I can now tell this particular story.
Yeah, and I would say, again, it is the narrator. It's not Anderson. The part you read about his own family being threatened with starvation was not included in this final version. And I think that there's a reason for that. It's alluded to at one point that they have to sometimes eat liver too, which apparently was given free by the butchers to families like his own. It's in there, but it's not forefronted. And I think that that's the genius rewrite here is that he left out any bitterness to his own father or his own poor childhood as somehow being akin. It informed the fiction, but I read this story as entirely separate from the other versions. This was the fiction off of the real, and it wasn't tethered to his mother being having a similar upbringing as the old woman. You know, it's all there, but he cuts it. It's just an incredible window into the fact that we can watch him making those cuts, because I think he ultimately knew for the story to work, he had to back off himself and create a fictional narrator, not himself telling a story.
Right. It's not a story that borrows the drama of the death from the way the woman lived. That doesn't work. I mean, then I think that this is something else. It's not about, oh, so the story borrows its pathos or the drama or what is just so tragic from the way the woman had to live her life, how had to live to feed everybody else. The story is really with the boy. The story is really the death in the woods. It's really not sort of imbued with any more importance or impact or weight or whatever, because we know all of these terrible things that this woman was born into, right?
Right.
It really becomes about how he waited to tell the story slowly and why that's important. Or maybe that doesn't make any sense. I don't know.
It makes a lot of sense. I think you just nailed it.
So when he says, let's see, when my brother told the story that night, when he got home and mother and sister sat listening, I did not think he got the point. He was too young. And so was I. A thing so complete has its own beauty. That's it.
That's it. And I think that's what he followed in order to get this right, is that he didn't need to dress it up with at least too many trappings, although there are trappings in this story that go close to being not only unnecessary, but distracting. But I think a story this great has to be imperfect, I think, you know? And so, like, I hail this story and I'll, you know, bow down before it, but I'm never going to pretend that it, you know, that every single thing works about it. I think that's what's so great about it.
I think that's how it is, how I feel about Anderson in general sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, again, I don't know a ton about him, but in some ways, I think whatever I wanted to know about him is in this story, you know, and what he decides to do in order to get to that sentence you just said, which is that, you know, that the, what's the, this the story in itself is enough. That says a lot about somebody, I think. There's a quote from the Israeli novelist Amos Oz, who says about this story that it has an air about it of a second simplicity. I'm not even sure what Oz means by a second simplicity, but it kind of resonates, the idea that, you know, he kind of, you know, like late simplicity, like this, I don't know, it there's something about it that I like, that he had to revisit simplicity, not just more than once, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I like knowing that. Sherwood Anderson is the author of Death in the Woods. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.